This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. A few dozen friends of mine gave me a wonderful Christmas present. They each recorded some Christmas stories for me to broadcast. These run the gamut from spiritual to funny, from touching to shocking to scary. We got some sci-fi, we've got some poetry, there are some songs and some jokes. Robin Bullock supplied the instrumental music. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
This is Laura Arwood, and I'd like to tell you the story of my favorite Christmas. It was when I was 13, and by that time, I had given up my yearly dream of getting a pony for Christmas. I had figured out that wasn't going to happen, even though every year I had run eagerly not to the tree, but to the front yard to see if the pony was there. But by 13, I had given that up. And a few months before Christmas that year, I had seen a neighbor who had gotten a beautiful star sapphire ring for her birthday. And I thought it was the most beautiful ring I had ever seen in my life. It was deep, beautiful blue. And it seemed like magic, the way the sunlight would bring the star out. And the way that when she moved her hand, the star would move with it. And I wanted one. I wanted one so badly. But we were raised in a lower middle class family. My father was a trucker, and my mother was an elementary school secretary. So it wasn't like we had a lot of money laying around. They took very good care of us and always gave us nice gifts for Christmas. But I knew that a piece of jewelry like this was going to be asking a lot. Nevertheless, I asked anyway. I took my mother the next time we were at the mall, and I slid her by the jewelry counter at Belk's, and I pointed it out. And she looked at it, and she looked at the price, and she looked at it, and she looked at the price, and then she looked at me. And then she shook her head. "I just don't know, Laura. This is awfully expensive, and you're awfully young. You have to be responsible when you get a nice piece of jewelry like this." Well, I wasn't encouraged by this, but I didn't give up entirely. So when Christmas rolled around, that morning we got up, and we all went into the living room where the tree was. And in my family, the tradition was that first we handed out all the gifts, so everyone had a pile in front of them. Then, one by one, each person would open a gift while everyone else looked on, so that we all could admire the gift and congratulate the giver on their good taste. Usually, Mother would direct which present got opened, because we would always ask, "Should I open this one first, or should I open that one first?" Because, again, the tradition in my family was we usually got one fairly large gift, and then maybe several smaller ones. So we were indulging in our tradition, and I opened my gifts. I got my yearly package of underwear, my yearly package of socks, a game, a book, and I'm sure other wonderful things. But as each round of gift opening passed, I got more and more anxious because there wasn't a ring. Then finally, each of us only had one gift left. And I looked at mine, and it wasn't the size of a ring box. But I thought, Maybe Mama is trying to fool me. Maybe she put the ring inside a bigger box. And maybe when I open this box, inside it will be the ring box. And since I was the youngest in the family, I always opened last. So Daddy went first and opened his big present. Mother opened hers. My oldest sister, Debbie, opened hers. Then my sister, Sherry, opened hers. Now, her big present was a small jewelry-sized box. And she had recently had her ears pierced. And inside the box was, I couldn't believe it, inside the box, decorated with little diamonds, were star sapphire earrings. My face fell. Not only had I not gotten my star sapphire ring, they had actually given the star sapphires to my sister. I was trying to hold back the tears as Sherry showed them around, showing them off, laughing about how happy she was over her gift. She held them out to me, and I sniffled and I said, they are very lovely, and I am very happy that you got them. And then I opened my gift. I don't even remember what it was now, but I do remember I bravely tried to hold back the tears, and I bravely tried to be excited over what it was, but even then, I was not that good of an actress. And so we're sitting around, and everybody's watching me, especially my dad, with my eyes slowly filling with tears, finally spilling down my cheeks. And finally, he couldn't stand it anymore. And he leaned over and he said, you know, Laura, I think there's one more present. I think there's a little bag that's hanging on the tree like an ornament. I flew and turned around and ran to the tree. And he was right. A little velvet bag. We had never hung presents on the tree before, so why would I have looked for something there? And on the little bag was a tag that said, to Laura, from Santa, ho, ho, ho. You can imagine, I almost tipped the tree over as I ripped the bag off. I opened it. It was a box, the exact size to hold a beautiful ring. I almost was afraid to open it, but finally I did. And there it was, beautiful sterling silver band and with swirls of silver that surrounded a lovely, oval, deep blue star sapphire ring. I started crying. I couldn't help it. They were tears of joy. And I turned around, I put the ring on, and then suddenly, one by one, every member of my family started crying too, even my dad. And I have to say that I am pretty hard on jewelry, and I've lost a lot of jewelry in my time. But the one piece of jewelry I have never lost is that ring. It's been on my hand since that Christmas 38 years ago. I wear it not only because I still think it's a beautiful ring, but also it reminds me of the leap of faith my parents took when they put their faith in an irresponsible young girl.
Matthew Wood, buy your own gift. Last Christmas, Grandpa was feeling his age and found that shopping for Christmas gifts had become too difficult. So he decided to send checks to everyone instead, and in each card, he wrote, buy your own present, and mailed them off early as usual. He enjoyed the flurry of family festivities, and it was only after the holiday that he had noticed that he had received very few cards in return. Puzzled over this, he went into his study, intending to write a couple of his relatives and ask what had happened. It was then, as he cleared off the clutter from his desk, he got his answer. Under a stack of papers, he was horrified to find the gift checks which he had forgotten to enclose with the cards. What to give an optimist and a pessimist for Christmas? A family had twin boys whose only resemblance to each other was their looks. If one felt it was too hot, the other was too cold, and if one said the TV was too loud, the other claimed that the volume needed to be turned up. opposite in every way. One was an internal optimist and the other doom and gloom pessimism all over. Just to see what would happen at Christmas time, their father loaded the pessimist room with every imaginable toy and game, and the optimist room he loaded with horse manure. That night, the father passed by the pessimist room and found him sitting there amid his new gifts, crying bitterly. "Why are you crying?" father asked. "Because all my friends will be jealous. I'll have to read all these instructions before I can do anything with this stuff. I'll constantly need batteries, and my toys will eventually get broken." Passing the optimist twin's room, the father found him dancing for joy on the pile of manure, and he said, "What are you so happy about?" And he said, "Well, with all this manure, there's bound to be a pony in there somewhere." Christmas holiday. Mrs. Oppenheimer decided to get away from the often inclement weather of New York City and spend Christmas in the deep south of the United States of America. Being unfamiliar with this part of the world, she wandered into a restricted hotel and said, "Hi, I'm Mrs. Oppenheimer and would like a room for the next week." "I'm very sorry," said the manager, "but all our rooms are taken." Just as he said that, a customer came to the desk, unexpectedly checking out. "How lucky," responded Mrs. Oppenheimer. "Now you have a room for me." "Look, I'm very sorry," said the manager, "but this is a restricted hotel. Jews are not allowed here." "Jewish? What do you mean, Jewish? I happen to be a Catholic." "Well, that takes some believing," said the manager. "Tell me, who was the Son of God?" "Jesus," she replied. "And where was he born?" "In a stable in Bethlehem, simply because a schmuck like you wouldn't rent a room to a Jew."
Hi, I'm David Serksner, and this is another Chelm Chanukah story. It's from The Jar of Fools by Eric A. Kimmel. It's called The Magic Spoon. One Chanukah Eve, a stranger appeared in Chelm, a handsome man wearing an elegant black coat and a tall silk hat. He carried a suitcase. No one knew his name or why he had come, but he was clearly a man of wealth and taste. Whether a stranger is rich or poor makes no difference to the people of Chelm. The people of Chelm are very hospitable. Any newcomer appearing in town is always invited to someone's home for dinner. "Come to my house. We're having latkes tonight. My wife, Esther, makes the best latkes in Chelm," said Simon Goose. "No, come home with me," Farvel Bonehead insisted. "You've never tasted latkes until you've tried the ones my mother makes." Everyone began arguing about who would have the honor of cooking latkes for the stranger. Finally, the stranger said, "Friends, there is no need to quarrel. I am going to cook my own latkes tonight. I invite all of you to be my guests." "How are you going to cook latkes without a stove, a bowl, or a pan?" Motka Fool asked. "You don't even have any potatoes." "Everyone knows you can't cook latkes with nothing." "You're wrong," the stranger replied. "You certainly can cook latkes with nothing, if you have a magic spoon." He opened his suitcase and took out a long wooden spoon. "It looks like an ordinary spoon," said Beryl Dunce. "There is nothing ordinary about it," the stranger exclaimed. "With this spoon, I can make latkes from nothing. You don't believe me? Bring me a mixing bowl, and I'll show you." "You can borrow mine," said Esther Goose. She ran home and brought back her mixing bowl. "Thank you," the stranger said. "Gather round, people of Chelm. Prepare yourselves to witness a miracle. You are about to see latkes made from thin air." The stranger held the mixing bowl while he stirred and stirred with the wooden spoon. Motka Fool looked into the bowl. "I don't see anything. What are you stirring? That bowl is empty." "Making latkes from nothing takes time," the stranger replied. "Trust me, it will be worth the wait." The people of Chelm watched as the stranger stirred and stirred. Suddenly he asked, "How do you like your latkes?" "I prefer mine plain. but some people like to add a pinch of salt. Salt! Of course you must add salt! What are latkes without salt? And pepper, too! Everyone agreed. I'll get some salt, said Beryl Dunce. He soon returned, carrying a salt shaker and a pepper mill. He threw a few pinches of salt into the bowl and added some pepper, too. Thank you, said the stranger, as he went on stirring. After a while, he looked up. These latkes will be fine the way they are. However, some people like to add one or two eggs, and maybe a handful of meal. Of course, Esther Goose exclaimed. You must add meal, and at least two eggs, and oil. Otherwise, the latkes will fall apart when you try to cook them. Keep stirring. I'll get what you need. Esther ran home and came back with three eggs, a cup of oil, and another cup of meal. Add these to the latkes. They'll taste wonderful, she said as she poured the ingredients into the bowl. Thank you, said the stranger. Look what's happening. The latkes are beginning to form. The people of Helm stared into the bowl. Amazing. A frothy yellow liquid had suddenly appeared. Keep stirring, the people of Helm cried. They could hardly contain their excitement. They were witnessing a miracle before their very eyes. The stranger stirred and stirred. After a while, he said, these latkes will taste delicious. There is only one thing we might add to make them better. What's that? Asked Simple Kalman. An onion. Of course, an onion! Why didn't we think of that? Why only one onion? Said Five O' Bonehead. Add lots of onions! Then the latkes will taste really good. Five O' ran home and chopped some onions. He came back and poured them into the bowl. That's just what we needed, the stranger said. I can't think of anything else. Except... Except what? Oh, never mind. It really isn't important. The latkes will be fine without... Without what? The people of Helm shouted. Well, if you really want to know, it never hurts to add a few potatoes. Potatoes! Of course! How can you make latkes without potatoes? The people of Helm ran home. They came back with potatoes, washed and grated. They poured them into the bowl. The results were amazing. Latkes, just the way I make them, Esther Goose gasped. If I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I wouldn't believe it, said Matka Fool. Imagine that. Latkes from nothing, cried Beryl Dunce. And now they're done. The stranger held out the bowl for all to see. Let's cook them and see how they taste. Everyone followed the stranger over to Esther Goose's house. Esther placed an iron pan on the stove. She poured in some oil. When it was hot, she added the latke mixture, a tablespoon at a time. The latkes began to cook. They filled the kitchen with their delicious smell. And to think this was all made from nothing, said Simple Kalman. He still couldn't believe it. Soon the latkes were done. Let's see how they taste, the stranger suggested. They tasted delicious. These are the best latkes I ever ate, said Matka Fool. I never cooked better ones myself, said Esther Goose. It is truly a miracle. Latkes from nothing, said the rabbi. The latkes disappeared in a flash. The people of Helm demanded more. So the stranger mixed up batch after batch with his magic spoon. The people of Helm provided the extra ingredients. When all had eaten their fill, the stranger washed his magic spoon. He dried it with his handkerchief and put it back in his suitcase. Thank you for a lovely evening and a happy, happy Hanukkah, he said. Now, if you will excuse me, I must be on my way. Where are you going? Stay here with us. Hanukkah's just begun. We can have latkes every night, said Beryl Dunce. The stranger shook his head. No, I really must be off. My friends in Lubin are expecting me. I have to leave now. Otherwise, I'll be late. Go, then. But may I ask if you might be interested in selling that magic spoon of yours? Matka Fool asked. Oh, no, cried the stranger. I couldn't sell this spoon to anyone. It has been in our family for 200 years. Then would you lend us the spoon for the rest of Hanukkah? We'll give it back when you return from Lubin. We'll pay you 500 zlotys, said Beryl Dunce. It's worth it just to taste those zlotkys again. The stranger hesitated. I'm not sure. What if the spoon broke? What if it got lost? Or stolen? Don't worry about it, said Matka. We'll pay you 500 zlotys and give you 1,000 more as a deposit. If, God forbid, anything were to happen to the spoon, the 1,000 zlotys would be yours to keep. How can you lose? I accept, the stranger replied. Everyone says the people of Chelm are honest folk. I'm sure I can trust you. Matka Fool opened up the iron box and counted out 1,500 zlotys. There you are, he said as he handed them to the stranger. The stranger put the money in his suitcase. He handed Matka the magic spoon. When I come back from Lubin, you'll return my spoon to me? Agreed, said Matka, and you'll give us back our 1,000 zlotys. They shook hands. The stranger smiled. Without another word, he tipped his hat, picked up his suitcase, and walked out of town. The people of Chelm feasted every night for the rest of Chanukah. They made piles and piles of latkes with the magic spoon. Of course, they added some extra ingredients. Salt, pepper, meal, oil, eggs, onions, and potatoes. But, strange to say, the mysterious stranger never came back. When he still hadn't appeared a month after Chanukah, the people of Chelm sent word to Lubin. Nobody there knew anything about him. The people of Chelm waited the rest of the year, and the next, and the year after that, but the stranger never returned. As long as we have the magic spoon, we may as well use it, said Matka Fool. So every year they made heaps and heaps of latkes out of thin air, enough for the whole town. Do you think the stranger will ever come back? Simon Goose asked as he spread applesauce and sour cream over his latkes. So what if he doesn't? Said stupid Schmelke, finishing his fifth helping. We still have the magic spoon. We can still make latkes from nothing. A secret like that is worth millions, and it only cost us 1,500 zlotys. Together they laughed. We got the best of that bargain. Hi, I'm David Serksner, and this is The Soul of a Menorah from the book The Jar of Fools by Eric Kimmel. The Chanukah menorah in the Grand Synagogue of Chelm is famous throughout the world. There is no other like it. Those seeing the menorah for the first time are often surprised. It looks exactly like a hay fork. But don't be fooled. It is a genuine Chanukah menorah. The great rabbi Jacob Isaac, the seer of Lubin, said so himself. Many years ago, a farmer drove his wagon through Chelm. He had a hay fork and some tools in the back, until the wagon hit a bump and the hay fork fell out. Beryl Dunce stumbled over it. What is this? He asked his friend, Fivel Bonehead. It looks like a hay fork, said Fivel. Look again, said Beryl. It has 9 branches. 8 of the branches are the same size, but the 9th is longer than the others. Only one object fits that description. A Chanukah menorah, Fivel exclaimed. This must be a Chanukah menorah, Beryl continued. But how would a Chanukah menorah come to be lying in the street? Maybe it came down from heaven. Perhaps this menorah is a gift from God to us, said Fivel. We can't leave it here. Quick, Fivel, let's clean up this menorah and take it to the synagogue where it belongs. Beryl and Fievel scraped the dirt off the hay fork and polished it until it shone. They oiled the wooden handle until it gleamed. Now the hay fork looked truly splendid. Beryl and Fievel carried it to the synagogue. "Why are you bringing a hay fork in here?" Bunim Ak shouted at Beryl and Fievel. "I just mopped the floor. Take that hay fork back to the stable, where it belongs." "Look again, Bunim," Fievel and Beryl said. "You've never seen a hay fork like this. It has 9 branches. Count them. One is taller than the rest. Only one object looks like that." "A menorah," Bunim gasped. "How did it get to Chelm?" "We found it in the street. Fievel thinks God threw it down from heaven," Beryl said. "How else could it have gotten here?" Fievel asked. "That doesn't matter," said Bunim. "What's important now is what we do with it. Right now, we have to get this menorah ready. It will be dark soon. People will be coming to light the Chanukah candles." Bunim stuck the hay fork in a bucket of sand so it wouldn't fall over. Since it was the 5th night of Chanukah, he took 6 thick candles and stuck them on the first 6 tines. The candle on the longer tine would serve as the shamash to light the others. When the men of Chelm gathered in the synagogue for evening prayers, they were surprised to see a hay fork standing in a bucket. "Why is the hay fork there?" they asked. "Open your eyes," said Bunim Ak. "Can't you tell a menorah when you see one?" "We found it in the street. God threw it down from heaven," Fievel and Beryl added. Word of the miraculous menorah spread through Chelm like fire through dry leaves. People from the surrounding countryside came streaming into town to see it. Among them was a farmer who had been searching all day long for a missing hay fork. "That's my hay fork," he shouted as soon as he saw the menorah. The people of Chelm were outraged. "Dolt! Mooncalf! Since when does a hay fork shine like silver? Did you ever see a hay fork lit with Chanukah candles?" "It's my hay fork, I tell you. I broke the handle once. I fixed it with a metal collar and 2 screws. Look, there they are." There were indeed a metal collar and 2 screws holding the wooden handle together. Was the farmer correct? What was this strange object? "It's a hay fork," the farmer insisted. "It's a menorah," Beryl, Fievel, and Bunim replied, just as firmly. Everyone turned to the rabbi. "What is this?" they asked him. The rabbi was the only person in town wise enough to solve the problem. "I don't know," the rabbi said. "It certainly does look like a hay fork. But it could also be a menorah. We'll need greater wisdom than mine to answer this question. We will have to bring the menorah, or the hay fork, to the seer." Rabbi Jacob Isaac, the seer of Lubin, was the holiest man of his time. He was called the seer because he could look into people's souls, solve unsolvable mysteries, and discover hidden meanings. If anyone could determine whether the menorah was really a hay fork or the hay fork was really a menorah, it would be the seer. Early the next morning, Fievel, Beryl, Bunim, the rabbi, and the farmer piled into a wagon and set out for Lubin. They took the hay fork with them. The entire population of Chelm came along, too. Fortunately, Lubin is not very far away. They arrived before noon and went at once to see the seer. The seer welcomed his visitors. After serving cake and wine, he asked how he could help them. "Tell us what this object is," the rabbi asked. "What do you think it is?" the seer asked him. "It's a menorah," said the people of Chelm. "It's a hay fork," the farmer said. The seer stroked his beard. "This is not an easy question to answer. The object has 9 branches. 8 of them are the same height, but one is taller than the others. So it could be a menorah. On the other hand, it does indeed look like a hay fork. There is only one way that I know to solve this problem. Our master, the great rabbi and teacher, Isaac Luria, of blessed memory, taught us not to be deceived by an object's outer appearance. We must always look inward to discover its hidden nature. Sparks of holiness can be found in the most common, ordinary things. A blind beggar singing in the marketplace might be an angel. An old boot may hold the key to a cosmic riddle. We must constantly search for these hidden sparks so that we can uncover their true holiness. I believe that this is what happened in this case. The people of Chelm discovered the holy sparks hidden in a hay fork. They lifted them up by transforming the hay fork into a holy object, a menorah. That's right, said Beryl, Fivel, and Bunim. The seer continued, once holy sparks have been lifted, they cannot be lowered. This object might have been a hay fork in its earlier existence, but now it is a menorah. It must remain a menorah. It cannot be used as a hay fork again. That would be a sin. This is true, said the rabbi. But what about me? Cried the farmer. I still need a hay fork. And you will have one, the seer said. He turned to the people of Chelm. The farmer has come here in good faith. He needs a hay fork to do his work. Here is my decision. The people of Chelm may keep their menorah, but they must also pay the farmer 18 zlotys as compensation. What? Cried the people of Chelm. 18 zlotys for a hay fork? What are you talking about? Said the farmer. Can't you tell a menorah when you see one? That is how the famous menorah came to the Grand Synagogue of Chelm. Don't be fooled. True, it may resemble a hay fork, but it has the soul of a menorah. That's what counts. I'm David Serksner, and this is the eighth and final of the Chelm Chanukah stories from the book The Jar of Fools by Eric A. Kimmel, and it's called Wisdom for Sale. Prince Radoswell once paid a visit to Chelm. The people of Chelm welcomed him as an honored guest. Since the prince arrived during the Chanukah season, they invited him to attend the lighting of the hay fork menorah in the Grand Synagogue. They let the prince examine the magic spoon and demonstrated how to make latkes from nothing. They presented him with a silver dreidel of the kind made only in Chelm. The prince could not stop laughing. He laughed so hard his grooms had to help him into his carriage. Just before leaving, he leaned out the windows and said to the people of Chelm, "Thank you for a wonderful time. I cannot remember when I have laughed so hard. A hay fork menorah, latkes made from nothing, a dreidel without letters. Ha 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 ha! You are the funniest people I ever met. What they say about Chelm is true. You are absolute fools." The people of Chelm were shocked. "Did you hear what the prince called us?" Beryl Dunce said. "Absolute fools." The words brought tears to Fivel Bonehead's eyes. "The prince is a clever man. He must know what he's talking about," said Simple Kelman. "If he says we're fools, maybe it's so." "I've heard other people say that," said Esther Goose. "I have never believed it before. I thought they were jealous. Now I'm not so sure." "Don't be discouraged," the rabbi said. "It is true that God has made some people less clever than others, but that does not mean they are fools. According to our great teacher, Rabbi Azariah of Chelm, the difference between a fool and a wise person is that a wise person always seeks wisdom, while a fool rests content in his ignorance. Therefore, If we seek to become wiser than we are, we cannot possibly be fools. How can we possibly be wiser than we already are? Asked Simon Goose. Where is more wisdom to be found? Think, said Bunim Ox. Prince Radiswell is a clever man. Where did he get his wisdom? Where do all the great families in our country send their sons to get wisdom? Where, everybody asked. To the great University of Krakow. The most prominent people in the land send their children there. Look at any great man in this country, and you will find that he is a graduate of the University of Krakow. This university must be full of wisdom. It must be good wisdom, too, if rich folks are buying it, said Matka Fool. Maybe we can buy some, too, said Beryl Dunce. I don't know, said Simple Kalman. This wisdom probably costs a great deal of money. Only the rich can afford it. We have 30,000 zlotys in the town treasury, said Fievel Bonehead. Surely we can afford to buy some wisdom. Besides, the children of the rich are absolute fools. We've all seen them racing their horses over the countryside, drinking and gambling like wild men. It must require a lot of wisdom to turn them into sensible human beings. We won't need as much. We're already wise. We just want to become a little wiser, that's all. I have an idea, said Matka Fool. Why don't we send a delegation to the University of Krakow and buy a sample of wisdom? We'll examine it. If we like it, we'll buy more. The people of Helm decided that was a good idea. They voted to send Beryl Dunce and Fievel Bonehead to Krakow with 400 zlotys from the town treasury to purchase a sample of wisdom. Krakow is nearly 300 miles from Helm. It took Beryl and Fievel 2 weeks to get there. When they arrived, they asked two young gentlemen how to get to the University of Krakow. As luck would have it, these two young gentlemen were students at the university. Are you going to enroll in one of the colleges? They asked. No, said Beryl. We don't have time for that. Back in Helm, we heard that the University of Krakow offers the finest wisdom in Europe. We came to buy a sample. If it's as good as everyone says, we'll come back for more. The two students winked at each other. They had heard about the people of Helm. Wisdom doesn't come cheap, especially not in Krakow, they told Beryl and Fievel. Our wisdom is the best. That's why it's so expensive. How much does it cost? Fievel asked. How much have you got? 400 zlotys. That won't buy much, but it should get you a small sample. That's all we want, said Beryl. Don't go away. We'll be right back. While Beryl and Fievel waited, the students ran around the corner to a nearby stable. They caught a horsefly and put him in a matchbox. They tied the matchbox tightly with string and sealed the knot with sealing wax. Here is your wisdom, they told Beryl and Fievel when they returned. Is that all? 400 zlotys doesn't buy very much, Fievel said as he counted out the money. Trust me, you won't be disappointed. The first student replied. Don't open the box until you get to Helm, the second student added. Beryl and Fievel promised not to look. They took the matchbox and started home. This must be good wisdom, said Beryl to Fievel as they walked along. Listen, I hear it buzzing. It's the same sound our rabbi makes when he studies the holy books. You know how wise he is. Fievel held the matchbox to his ear. You're right. I can hear it, too. I wonder what this Krakow wisdom looks like. We promised not to open the box until we got to Helm, Beryl reminded him. What's the harm? A little peek can't hurt. Fievel broke the seal and unwound the string. He pushed open the matchbox. The horsefly flew out. It stung Fievel between the eyes. Ow! yelped Fievel. He smacked his forehead. That was the end of the horsefly, along with 400 zlotys worth of wisdom. "Now you've done it! You've smashed our wisdom," said Beryl. "Very strange," said Fievel. "The wisdom of Krakow resembles a squashed horsefly. I never thought horseflies were particularly clever creatures. We have plenty of them in Helm. Maybe the ones in Krakow are different." "We'll never know now," said Beryl. "Our wisdom is gone." "No, it isn't," said Fievel. "I think I got some of it into my head. I feel myself getting smarter." "You're right," said Beryl. "I can see your brain swelling." He pointed to the lump on Fievel's forehead where the horsefly stung him. "What are you thinking about with your new wisdom?" "I'm thinking we should have listened to that student in Krakow when he warned us not to look in the matchbox. Well, what's gone is gone, and nothing will bring it back. But we did learn something. The wisdom of Krakow is definitely worth the money. I think we should buy some more." Beryl agreed. When the two returned to Helm, they explained to their neighbors that the wisdom of Krakow was so superior it required a great deal of wisdom just to carry it from one place to another. "If that's true, then we definitely need some of that wisdom here," said Matka Fool. He counted out 800 zlotys from the town treasury and handed it to Fievel. "Go back to Krakow and buy more wisdom. Get twice as much this time." Beryl and Fievel returned to Krakow. They stopped at a tavern. Here they encountered the same two students they had met before. "Did you like the wisdom?" the students asked. "We did," said Beryl. "We want to buy twice as much this time. 800 zlotys worth." The students' eyes opened wide when they saw the money. "We'll get you some wisdom. The very best." The students caught a mouse and put it in a box with some grain and wool soaked with water. They tied the box with string and sealed it with sealing wax. Then they went back to the tavern. "Here's your wisdom," they told Beryl and Fievel. Beryl counted out the money, while Fievel held the box to his ear. "This must be good wisdom," he said. "It squeaks, like the door to our rabbi's library. You know how much wisdom that library contains? Remember, don't open the box until you get to Helm," the students told them. "You don't have to remind me. I know that," said Fievel, tapping his forehead. "I'm smarter now." Beryl and Fievel brought the box back to Helm. Everyone gathered in the town hall to have a look at this new wisdom. Beryl broke the seal. Fievel unwound the string. They handed the box to Matka Fool, who opened it. A mouse jumped out. People screamed. They scrambled to get out of the way of the mouse as it streaked across the floor, straight into the jaws of the town hall cat. The people of Helm were outraged. "You wicked cat," they screamed. "What right have you to take our wisdom? You didn't pay for it. Give it back. You can't keep all that wisdom for yourself." The cat ignored them. She began licking her paws. "I'll get our wisdom back," said Simple Calman. He tried to grab the cat. He might as well have tried to grab the wind. The cat slipped through his hands and ran out the door. The people of Helm chased it around the town. The cat climbed the statue of Silent Samson and leaped onto the roof. "What do we do now?" the people of Helm asked. "Leave it to me," said Fievel. "That cat thinks she's smart because she's full of wisdom. Well, I have some wisdom, too. I know how to get her down."
"How?" "Set fire to the building. She'll come down as soon as she sees the flames."
"Fievel is right," the people of Helm exclaimed. They lit torches and set fire to the town hall. The building was ablaze within minutes. Fievel proved correct. The cat leaped onto the bakery roof.
"What will we do?" the people of Helm asked. "Burn the bakery," said Fievel.
The people of Helm set fire to the bakery. The cat leaped to the roof of the butcher shop. The people of Helm set fire to the butcher shop. The cat leaped to the roof of Simple Calman's house.
"Burn it," said Fievel, again and again. The cat leaped from roof to roof until she reached the edge of town. She jumped to the ground and ran into a field. The people of Chelm didn't have the strength to chase her. By then, the whole town was ablaze. What went wrong? The people of Chelm asked Fievel. Fievel sighed. I made a mistake. I should have known from the beginning that I could never outsmart that cat. After all, I only have 400 zlotys worth of wisdom. The cat has twice as much. She must be the cleverest cat in the world. No wonder she made fools of us. Never mind. All is not lost, said Matka Fool. The wisdom of Krakow has proven its value. We have seen a cat outsmart a whole town with just 800 zlotys worth. I say we use whatever money is left in our treasury to buy wisdom. Let's send Beryl and Fievel back to Krakow to buy enough for everyone. This time we'll know how to handle it. We'll all be geniuses. Chelm will be the most famous town in Europe. People will come from London, Paris, Rome, even Krakow, to learn from us. Yes, yes, everyone cried. By wisdom, Chelm will be famous. Hurrah for Chelm. Beryl and Fievel took the 28,800 zlotys left in the town treasury and went back to Krakow. This time they traveled in a wagon, for they intended to buy a lot of wisdom, more than two men could carry. They had hardly arrived in the city when they ran into the same two students. You're back, they said. Did you come for more wisdom? That's right, said Fievel. This time we want to buy enough for everyone in Chelm. 28,800 zlotys worth. Oi! That's a lot of wisdom. It may take a while to gather it. We'll wait, said Beryl. We have plenty of time. Stay right here. We'll be back. The students ran to the fish market. They bought a barrel of spoiled herring and rolled it back through the streets to where Beryl and Fievel were waiting. That wisdom smells terrible, Fievel remarked as the students lifted the barrel into the wagon. Are you sure it isn't spoiled? Of course not, the students replied. The best wisdom always smells ripe. It's like old cheese. It smells more like old fish, said Beryl, holding his nose. Hush! We came to buy wisdom, not perfume, Fievel told his friend. He counted out the money. Don't open the barrel until you get to Chelm, the students reminded them. Don't worry, we won't go near it, Beryl and Fievel said. Beryl and Fievel started down the road to Chelm. They didn't stop until they arrived in Chelm's town square. Feh! What smells? Said Esther Goose. It's the odor of wisdom, Beryl and Fievel told her. We bought a barrel full in Krakow. I thought wisdom was supposed to smell sweet, said stupid Schmelke. Only to the wise, the rabbi explained. As our great teacher, Rabbi Ezria of Chelm, wrote, the smell of wisdom is a sweet savor to the wise, but a stench to fools. That barrel really smells bad. It must mean that we're really stupid, said Simple Hellman. Not for long, Beryl and Fievel exclaimed. There's enough wisdom in this barrel for everyone in Chelm. As soon as we taste it, we will all be wise. The barrel will smell sweeter than perfume. The people of Chelm handed the barrel down from the wagon. They could hardly wait to be wise, if for no other reason than to get rid of that terrible smell. Bunam Ox pried open the barrel. He stuck in his head, took a deep breath, and fainted. If Beryl and Fievel hadn't caught him, he would have fallen head first into the barrel. Are you wiser now? Everyone asked after he recovered his senses. I don't think so, said Bunim. I must be getting stupider. That barrel smells worse than before. Something is wrong, the rabbi said. He pulled a piece of wisdom from the barrel and tasted it. Feh! He cried, spitting it out. This wisdom tastes like rotten herring. It smells like rotten herring. It is rotten herring. The people of Helm were furious. 28,800 zlotys for a barrel of rotten herring. We were cheated. It's all Fievel's fault. Barrels, too. Throw them in jail. Tie them to the whipping post. Run them out of town. Now wait, the rabbi said. Beryl and Fievel are not guilty. We sent them to Krakow to buy wisdom, and they did. Aren't we wiser now? Haven't we learned a great lesson? Did we? Of course we did. Listen, and I will explain. The people of Helm gathered around to hear the rabbi's words. Before we opened that barrel, we were fools. We couldn't tell a barrel of wisdom from a barrel of rotten herring. Now we can. Before, we didn't know those rascals in Krakow were cheating us. Now we do. Before, we thought the wisdom of Helm was worthless compared to the wisdom of strangers. Now we know the value of our own true wisdom, the wisdom that God himself sent down from heaven at the time of creation. Compared to the wisdom of Helm, the wisdom of the rest of the world is nothing but a barrel of rotten fish. But why did Prince Radoswell laugh at us? Think, where did Prince Radoswell go to school? He went to the University of Krakow. The poor man's brain is stuffed with rotten herring, and he calls it wisdom. No wonder he laughed at us. If a person who cannot hear sees people dancing, he laughs at them too. He thinks they are fools to leap and jump about so. But they are not fools. He cannot hear the music, but they can, and so can we. The barrel of rotten herring was rolled to the town dump. A new Helm arose from the ashes of the old. Nowhere in the world is Chanukah celebrated with greater joy. The hayfork menorah is lit. Delicious latkes are made from nothing with the magic spoon. Dreidels without letters spin. And the people of Helm dance night and day to the music that they alone can hear. L'shana tova.
Matthew Wood, Chrismica. Continuing the current trend of large-scale mergers and acquisitions, it was announced today at a press conference that Christmas and Hanukkah will merge. An industry source said that the deal had been in the works for about 1,300 years. While details were not available at the time, it was believed that the overhead cost of having both 12 days of Christmas and 8 days of Hanukkah was becoming prohibitive for both sides. By combining forces, we're told, the world would be able to enjoy consistently high-quality service during the 15 days of Chrismica, as the new holiday is being called. Massive layoffs are expected, with Lords of Leaping and Maids of Milking being the hardest hit. As part of the conditions of the agreement, the letter on the dreidel, currently in Hebrew, will now be replaced by Latin, thus becoming unintelligible to a wider audience. Also, instead of translating "A great miracle happened there," the message on the dreidel will be a more general, "Miraculous stuff happens." In exchange, it is believed that Jews will be allowed to use Santa Claus and his vast merchandising resources for buying and delivering their gifts. One of the sticking points holding up the agreement for at least 300 years was the question of whether Jewish children could leave milk and cookies for Santa even after having eaten meat for dinner. A breakthrough came last year when Oreos were finally declared to be kosher. All sides apparently are happy about this. A spokesman for Christmas Incorporated declined to say whether a takeover of Kwanzaa might be in the works as well. He merely pointed out that if it were not for the independent existence of Kwanzaa, the merger between Christmas and Hanukkah might indeed be seen as an unfair cornering of the holiday market. Fortunately for all concerned, he said, Kwanzaa will help to maintain a competitive balance. Then he closed the press conference by leading all present in a rousing rendition of Oy Vey, All Ye Faithful.
Christmas cards. A form of Christmas card began in England first when young boys practiced their writing skills by creating Christmas greetings for their parents. But it is Sir Henry Cole who is credited with creating the first real Christmas card. The first director of London's Victoria and Albert Museum, Sir Henry found himself too busy in the Christmas season of 1843 to compose individual Christmas greetings for his friends. He commissioned artist John Calcott Horsley for the illustration. The card featured three panels, with the center panel depicting a family enjoying Christmas festivities, and the card was inscribed with the message, "A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you." Christmas stockings. The tradition of the Christmas stockings began by a story told since ancient time about a kind nobleman who had three daughters. The wife of the nobleman expired, and the daughters and their father were left in a state of sorrow. The daughters had to do all the work in the house. When the daughters became young and eligible for marriage, the poor father could not afford to give the huge dowries to their husbands. One evening, the daughters, after washing their stockings, hung them near the fireplace to be dried. Santa Claus, being moved by the plight of the daughters, came in and put in three bags of gold, one in each stocking hanging by the chimney. The next morning, the family noticed the gold bags, and the nobleman had enough for his daughter's marriage. The daughters got married, and they lived happily ever after. Since then, children have been hanging Christmas stockings.